Hi, this is Pastor Greg, and you're listening to Chosen Generation Radio. Get more at ChosenGenerationRadio.com. That's Chosen Generation Radio, where no topic is off limits and everything filtered through biblical glass.
My passion is the fight for freedom. My father fought for World War II defending our country. Today, we are no longer fighting with guns. Instead, we are fighting an ideological battle for control of our country by contributing to causes that support your constitutional rights. I am Patriot Mobile.
I thank and praise God for this borewell that God has enabled us to put in this village with the prayer and support of Pastor Greg Young and Chosen Generation Radio Ministry, and by the prayer and support of the Pastor Greg Young and the Chosen Generation Ministry, we could put the borewell in this village for the community. Before, this community was drinking dirty water, and that was really causing a lot of sickness. But now they are getting pure and fresh water, and all the community is so thankful for Pastor Greg Young and Chosen Generation Ministry and all the supporters. And we pray for all of you that God would bless you and God would use you so that we can put more and more borewells in a poor and a needy community, those who are really having a problem of the water. And this is this borewell we have put, and pure and fresh water is coming, and we are so thankful for all of you. Especially we thanks to Pastor Greg Young and Chosen Generation Ministry that help us and support us to put the borewell. Thank you. God bless you.
Hi, I'm Tim Sheff, a certified natural health practitioner of over 40 years. I want to introduce you to a product that changed my life. The product's called Vibe, available at cgrwellness.com. I thought I was on a good nutritional program before I discovered Vibe. I was taking the traditional vitamin mineral tablets, wasn't really feeling any difference. So I tried Vibe. Vibe is an all-in-one vitamin mineral supplement. It's a liquid multivitamin. It's cold-pressed, whole food sourced, non-radiated, gluten-free, and has no pasteurization. Vibe is like fresh juicing without all the work. It supports four areas of the body: cardiovascular health, immune health, anti-aging, and healthy cell replication. Vibe is available in a 32-ounce bottle for home use or a very handy 1-ounce travel packet for life on the go. The first time I tried Vibe, I had more energy in about 20 minutes. I started thinking clear. Even believe I slept better. Get yours today at cgrwellness.com. Coupon code ChosenGenRadio at checkout and receive $20 off your first order of $50 or more. That's cgrwellness.com. Coupon code ChosenGenRadio. Get yours today.
These statements have not been evaluated by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. Any of the products do not treat, reduce, cure, or prevent disease.
Welcome to Chosen Generation with your host, Pastor Greg Young.
But you are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a peculiar people, that you should shew forth the praises of him who has called you out of darkness into his marvelous light, which in time past were not a people, but are now the people of God, which had not obtained mercy, but now have obtained mercy.
And now, Chosen Generation, where no topic is off limits and everything is filtered through biblical glasses. And now, here's your host, Pastor Greg.
And welcome to the program. Great to have you with me. Thanks so much for being here. I know you have a choice in where you can listen each and every day, and I thank you for keeping it tuned here to Chosen Generation Radio, where no topic is off limits and everything filtered through biblical glasses. Well, I've got a great program lined up for you. Bottom of hour number three. We're doing 3 hours today. Bottom of hour number three, D.D. Laugesen will be with me. Save the Persecuted Christians. Lots to talk about with Dee Dee today. Obviously, we'll be talking about what's going on in Israel, the war on Israel. There was a webinar that was done to try to give even more explanations regarding that. We followed that quite closely here. If you go to our Rumble page, Chosen Generation Radio Show on Rumble, Chosen Generation Radio Show on Rumble, we've done 2.5, 3, 4, 5, about 6 or 7 hours of live coverage with David Wormser, Dr. David Wormser, in Tel Aviv, as well as in Jerusalem. As a matter of fact, on our last telecast that we did on Monday, he had to leave the broadcast at one point because of the air raid sirens going off and an alert of incoming bombs where he was in Jerusalem. But he has been updating us on things going on over there, and we've been going through where there have been issues raised about the attack, what happened, how it happened, and so on. We've been sharing a lot of that information with you, actually, for the last almost a year. We in one of our most recent episodes, we warned that there likely would be war. We put up a map of Israel and showed you where we believe the invasions would come from: Gaza, Lebanon, Syria. We described the players. We described who they were, what they were about, why they were doing it. We described what "to the sea" meant, what a two-state solution was really all about. And we gave you a very clear perspective of the challenges that were faced. And we also went very deeply into the challenges that were faced by the very first time since 1948 that an Israeli government was actually truly conservative and focused on returning Israel to being the God-focused country that it was originally founded as, called by God as, when he called Abram and told him, "This is the land that you will possess." We'll talk about that. We'll also talk about what's called Red Ed, and that's the CCP and Friends Marxist brainwashing and subversion of our education system. Michael Morris will be with me from Newsbusters and MRC. We'll have Rick Manning. We'll be talking about the Speaker of the House battle and what's taking place and what to expect there today and as this moves forward. And then also Melanie Collette will be with me today, and we're going to talk about politics in New Jersey and her congressional run. So we'll get into that today coming up. But joining me now, as he does on Wednesdays, and always, always, always a pleasure to have him join me, our constitutional originalist, David Shostokas. David, welcome. Good to have you.
Thank you so much, Greg. Good morning. It's great to be with you and your audience today. All kinds of things. Sometimes, of course, often when we finish up, I have to run out and get into a courtroom, in which case it's really, really disappointing to hear all the things that you have coming up, you know, and wishing that I could either call in or participate or listen more, you know. But thank goodness, most of the time you're available to catch up with later on Rumble and otherwise. So I try and keep pace with the world. Thanks to you.
Wow. You know, thank you. I appreciate that. Well, and I appreciate these opportunities for us to come together and talk about, you know, these issues through a constitutional lens, because there isn't anything that we're supposed to be doing that isn't impacted by that. And as I'm, you know, reflecting, yesterday I had a guest that was on, and we were talking about this terrorism or Communism Awareness Act. And it's legislation that's being pushed through. I believe it may be just in the area that she's in, but it specifically supposedly is designed to push back on or teach the ills of communism. But the problem is that it's being done under the auspices of keeping Common Core in place, which is not good for our education system. And then the advocates keep pushing democracy. We've got to do this for our democracy. Now, it seems to me, David, that there's so many people that just don't get that we're not a democracy, and that they're, you know, literally kind of shooting themselves in the foot, right? To suggest, well, we're going to battle communism by using the concept that we're a democracy. That's not a winning combination, is it?
I would suggest that it's not a winning combination. Of course, in terms of a primer on that subject, of course, we are not a democracy. As you mentioned, we were designed to be a constitutional republic. And the idea of a constitutional republic is, in fact, to protect minority thought from the tyranny of the majority. And they're trying to impose the tyranny of the majority in that situation. And so there's always there's always a debate on it in terms of education, in terms of what gets taught, whether it's truth or not. You know, while you were talking about they're trying to say communism, I presume that's in juxtaposition to capitalism, which, of course, they're not exactly separate and apart from one another either. But I always think people should always, in terms of the debates that go on in terms of education, might be a good idea to watch the movie Inherit the Wind and the whole Scopes monkey trial situation from almost 100 years ago now, where the two famous folks, William Jennings Bryan and Clarence Darrow, were at odds in a courtroom as to evolution versus creation. And it's an ongoing battle in terms of what gets taught in public schools. But the fact is this is all an argument to go to total vouchers and let parents decide where their kids go. You can support education without indoctrination by allowing parents to choose schools. So it's a very, very complex subject, but to your question is, no, we're not a democracy. The founders expected that there would be what they call in a democracy, the tyranny of the majority. And that is where 50% plus one gets to decide for everybody else what happens. And that, in fact, I would suggest to you is practically the definition of communism, because communism says the state owns everything and the state gets to allocate everything, whether it's rights or property. And if you have 50% plus one, the 50% plus one are quite capable of saying, we own everything and we will tell the rest of you how the world is supposed to work. And that's actually pure democracy and communism are pretty much the same thing. And that's why we're not a democracy.
It's H.R. 5349, and it's actually a federal bill that's been introduced in the House of Representatives, and it's called Crucial Communism Teaching Act. And again, these are the kinds of things, and there's a lot of Republicans that are pushing for this as well. But you know, all of their endorsements all speak about the importance of our democracy.
Right.
And again, you know, I think this goes to what we've been talking about before, and that is the indoctrination in our education system and a lack of understanding what you just clearly were explaining. It cuts multiple ways. It's the ability for each individual's voice to matter in decisions that are being made regarding the general population. So the other side, you know, the danger side. And let me ask you this. This is going to seem a little off, but I don't know that it is. But, for example, the First Amendment and freedom of speech. We have individuals that are in the streets in support of Hamas. Now, Hamas has clearly said that their goal is to kill Jews, to wipe Israel off the map, but it's also to kill Americans and wipe America off the map. So when you have, you know, because I'm thinking about this in terms of, okay, in World War II, if you had Nazis marching in the street in America, would their free speech right give them the ability to continue to march for the anarchy and destruction of our country? Or would that make them an enemy combatant? Because I look at it as a citizen, it's fine for us to discuss, again, you know, policies, even perhaps ideologies, but to call for the burning down and destruction or anarchy, I don't know, or even to declare war from our streets. Where does that sit?
I was fortunate over the weekend to run into the old 50-year-old movie called Skokie, which was all about the Nazis and their proposal to infect. And actual Nazis, these people said they were the National Socialist Party of America, and they wore swastikas and et cetera. And then their intent to hold a march within down in the village of Skokie, Illinois. All the debate goes on is in the movie relative to free speech and Nazi situations, and their professed ideology to, in fact, essentially commit genocide against Jews. And I would encourage folks to watch. It's on YouTube. They just put it on YouTube about 2 weeks ago, probably regarding this is available. It's a 50-year-old movie. The debate, the First Amendment debate that goes on in the movie, and yet against the backdrop of Holocaust survivors having this in the streets of the hometown, because Skokie, Illinois, still to this day, is largely a Jewish population made up of still many Holocaust survivors and their children. And so I would encourage folks to watch that, because all the issues that you're talking about are brought forth in that situation. The United States Supreme Court still at one point ruled that they were able to conduct their march and that this was speech. But the debate as to whether or not we should ignore such things and close the windows and close the doors and just assume that they're going to go away because they're allowed to speak is no, that's the actual other side of the debate is you're supposed to. The idea of free speech is to allow both sides to be able to talk about what they want to talk about. And presumably the marketplace of ideas will, in fact, be effective and win. But I would also say that these days we have a lot more hate speech legislation that where, in fact, you do things that encourage violence becomes criminalized. And the people that are doing these marches just clearly don't understand what they're doing, because these are most of them are the same folks that are in favor of LGBTQ plus whatever the alphabet soup of the day is, most of those rights, and the Hamas folks and that community are not only in favor of killing Jews, but they're in favor of exterminating folks that have different sexual preferences and peccadilloes. So I would suggest that they need to learn what they're putting together. And now we've got a different debate where Vivek is saying, well, these are just stupid young people that we should, just give them a pass because they're stupid young folks. And that's just ignorant as well. I used to like Vivek, but that's just crazy, because these people are actually supporting murders and genocide, and so that goes beyond stupidity. That makes you dangerous, and so but it is protected speech. But when speech becomes provocative, that is what they call fighting words. That's no longer speech. From that standpoint, it's not considered free political speech. So it's a complex situation. But it still comes back to your first question, and that's education. Free speech is going to come up. I want to talk a little bit when we get a chance about the judge that tells President Trump he can't say stuff. When we get there, because that's an absolute First Amendment thing. And President Trump is such a groundbreaker. He's, you know, criminal defendants are supposed to be innocent until they're proven guilty. So how is it a judge can tell a criminal defendant that he can't say things about his trial? It's certainly one thing for the judge to have some control over the lawyers. Right. Because the lawyers are within the legal system. They have certain rights and privileges. But a criminal defendant, if I'm not mistaken, is innocent until he's proven guilty. And if a criminal defendant wants to try his case in the court of public opinion, I suggest that he has every right. The only reason for a judge to issue such an order is the judge doesn't want to be embarrassed.
These are the same orders that we've seen repeatedly when it comes to a lot of the J6 defendants. The majority of them were given a form of a gag order and told that they were not allowed to speak about their case. They couldn't defend themselves publicly while there was this onslaught of misleading and disinformation. I saw a post in my Facebook feed of someone asking for prayer, but there was a, let me see if I can find his name. He ran for governor in Michigan. Ryan Kelly had run for governor against Governor Whitmer in Michigan. He went on January the 6th, and he was just sentenced to 60 days in prison.
These are situations you're describing, and so many people don't have the megaphone to match the governments or the government supported press. And I mean, not necessarily financially, but rather philosophically, where the press is supporting the government. So the whole debate that's going on. Of course, the reporters say, well, we can say whatever we want. The reporters report what they want about the trial, about the story. And yet the criminal defendant himself is muzzled in terms of doing this. This has probably been a problem throughout our history, but there's never been a criminal defendant with a megaphone that equals the government's. To challenge this, challenge these orders, because those orders, most of the, you can understand the lawyers and the situation where, once again, they're involved with, say, the discovery matters, and there might be some sort of sensitivity regarding, say, the identities of confidential informants. Very limited circumstances, but if somebody wants to criticize the judge, if somebody wants to criticize, for that matter, the jury, the process, why is a criminal defendant supposedly supposed to shut up about what's going on at his trial when it comes to the press? I can see no good reason for that except the protection of the government. Mm-hmm. And that's what free speech is all about. It would be interesting because apparently President Trump said she's issued an order. I'm going to talk anyway. If they want to lock me up, I'll go to jail. This is the ultimate in civil disobedience, but that is how you, in fact, handle those kinds of things. But there is nobody with a megaphone to match the president's, except maybe, 60 some odd years ago when they locked up Martin Luther King. And he continued to talk, and some of his people continued to talk. So when there's a wrong, You it's very unusual, but I would hate to be the lawyer that walked in and said, Mr. President, you can't talk anymore.
We're going to have Enrique Tarrio's mom, Zuni, on our program tomorrow. Uh-huh. To talk about, some of this very stuff, because, it would certainly appear that her son is, it's all political. Right. This is 100% political, and you know, when you stop and think about what we're seeing, and you know, dictators like Maduro and Putin and Xi, and the you know, Iranian leadership, and what we're battling. I mean, we're watching some of that same kind of tyranny take place here in our country. And I want to be clear once again with my audience. When we talk about what we're dealing with, we are not against the constitutional republic form of government that our founding fathers envisioned. Quite to the contrary. What we are pushing for, what we are desiring, is a return to that form of government where everyone has an equal voice. And it's so interesting to watch the other side talk about equality and tolerance and all those kinds of things. But there is no equality and there is no tolerance when it comes to the perspective that we're talking about.
Right.
There just plain is not. And, you know, again, they run with the J6 narrative, and you can't take in all of the actual facts surrounding that day and then come to the conclusion, in my opinion, that this was an insurrection. This was American citizens expressing their deeply held convictions and provable facts that the current government is not acting within the confines of the Constitution in defending the rights of American citizens, period.
Yeah, pretty much, period. There's not much to add to that. And it becomes very, very frustrating in so many places. And so many things that they're prosecuting or persecuting these days are actually for the protection of the government, not the protection of the rights of the people. I think you've done some stuff with people with the classified documents, and their documents number in the billions. Classified documents, 99% of them are not for the protection of the republic or the safety of the people, but rather for the protection of the people that generated the documents, to keep them out of the limelight and to keep them from being accountable. That's the secrecy level is well beyond what the government is supposed to do. That's the same kind of thing about these gag orders that you're speaking of. The gag orders in theory are actually they put them out and say that this is to protect against the bringing the court into disrepute. Well, if the court's not doing its job properly or the court's not following the law, it seems to me that the court should be brought into disrepute or the court should be challenged in that regard. And that's what gag orders are supposed to do. They're protecting the government. They're not protecting the defendant. Most of the time, of course, I do a lot of criminal defense work, and 99% of the time or better, I tell my client to shut up. Because right. of the whole Fifth Amendment thing, anything you say can and will be held against you in a court of law, and that's largely true. And so it's typically not beneficial for a defendant to go out and comment on the case in public. And so, I'm from time to time, some cases are in the news, and when I tell my defendant, I said, you can talk about this, but don't talk about that, because this is something that potentially can harm you. There's a reason the Fifth Amendment is there.
Right.
But the Fifth Amendment is to protect the accused, right?
Even from self-harm. Yeah.
But a gag order is to protect the court. It's not there to protect the defendant. It's there to protect the court. And so a gag order, I would suggest, even though they've been historically used through the course of our country, and they've been historically accepted, I would say that it's actually anathema to the First Amendment when you impose it on the defendant. Imposing a gag order on some of the other participants that may have access to information that's perhaps not otherwise publicly known. And by participants, I mean attorneys, paralegals.
Well, the jurors. You don't want the jurors out holding press conferences after every session. And I think that there's a reasonable expectation that the juror would be, at least during the trial, would be protected or somewhat anonymous, and so attacks by the criminal side against them in an effort to try to intimidate them, but we've seen that from the other side. We've seen the other side in cases where they were trying to get a particular opinion. We've seen them dox certain members of juries and things of that nature. And we've seen very little done. Just, the judge just kind of throw their hands up and say, well, there's really not much I can do about that. So yes, there's a certain, I would think, an expected behavior, yeah, right?
There's places that it added that. Some there's places and people for whom such orders
are necessary. Yeah,
certain information confidential. Mm-hmm. But as to the criminal defendant, there himself or herself, it would seem to me that there is no basis for infringing on their First Amendment rights. If they want to criticize the court while the case is going on, why can't they?
Well, and I would think, too, to your point, if they're out there saying things, again, it's a double-edged sword. So, let them speak. If they accidentally or if they say something, it can be used, and the prosecution can grab that quote and bring it into the courtroom. If it becomes evidentiary to the prosecution. So it's really, that's kind of where the, self-imposed gag order exists, right?
Yeah, no, it's a gag order. 90% of the gag order is there for the protection of the court, not the protection of the defendant. Right. When courts issue things that are for the protection of the government, I would suggest to you that they're anathema to the idea that our government exists to protect our rights. Certainly, if President Trump wants to challenge such a thing and risk going to jail, that would actually be in keeping with the civil disobedience of philosophies of Gandhi and Martin Luther King. Okay, he says no. This is an illegal and important, immoral order, and I am not going to obey it. Let the court do what they want, and I will submit to the punishment for not failing to obey it. But I'm going to challenge this. He's one of the few people that have the power of the megaphone to be able to do such a thing. Like you said, the same situation existed for probably many of the J6 defendants, where there were things being said about them in the press, being said about their cases in the press, being said by congressmen in the J6 hearings and whatnot, and yet they were muzzled. They could not be part of the debate of defending themselves in public, because of course then they would run the risk of being jailed for commenting on their case. Again, that would be their own decision. I'm sure their attorneys would tell them to be quiet for any number of reasons. But certainly, I've got this situation going on that there's a lot of press interest in with Reverend Stephen Lee. We do quite a few things because it's interesting for the folks to know about Pastor Lee's history of service and serving at 9/11 and serving at the Las Vegas Mandalay Bay shootings. He's been involved in many, many newsworthy events. But when it comes to commenting on the case, it's unwise for him to do so. He does not. These are decisions that people need to make. But you have to understand that when a judge issue tells a criminal defendant they can't say something, it's protecting the government. It's not protecting the defendant. And anytime the government, and that's classified documents, and the government does so many things to protect itself rather than protecting our rights. And we are in a post-constitutional world because long ago, back in the 1940s, once they had this Wickard versus Filburn and said the Commerce Clause could regulate the fact that a farmer was growing wheat in his backyard to grow bread for his family or to make bread out for his family out of the wheat. The federal government has had their fingers in everything, including the little pond that forms outside the back of your house when it rains. And so those are all for expansion of government, not for the protection of people. And you're exactly right when you say the goal is to return to limited government whose purpose exists to protect our rights.
And one of those cases is the Chevron case that we've talked about. And it looks like the justices are adding to that particular piece of legal argument that they've taken on another case that matches that. Let's see. Friday afternoon. So you've got Relentless versus the Department of Commerce and Loper Bright Enterprises versus Raimondo, both of which challenge the 1984 Chevron versus Natural Resources Defense Council decision.
Another case where you're talking about a situation where the government has made rules to protect itself rather than protect the rights of the people. Just as a little primer, I know you and I have discussed this before, but just for background for the folks, the Chevron decision is a decision that allows the alphabet soup of federal agencies to not only make law, that is, to issue regulations regarding the area that they're to regulate, but rather also to enforce those regulations, and then make judicial decisions interpreting those regulations that they issue. And so, and back in 1984, the Supreme Court said, yeah, you know what? We're going to let these agencies make these kinds of judicial decisions, which the Constitution reserves for the courts. And the courts will have to defer to the agency's interpretation of the law that governs the agency. It's utter insanity. But it's there to protect the agency, not to protect the rights of Americans. The Chevron philosophy is another situation where the government is acting to protect itself, not to protect the rights of the people for which it exists.
There's an interesting aside as I'm reading the SCOTUS blog on this, that the Relentless versus Department of Commerce case also allows Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson to not recuse herself. So that means it's a case that the full court now will be allowed to bring a decision on, which I think is significant. And that may be the reason why they did it is they didn't want when they bring the decision, they didn't want somebody to say, well, you know, you barely won, but you whatever. It also says, although the court might normally have simply put the case on hold, it ruled in the Loper Bright case. The court instead took the unusual step of fast-tracking the Relentless case for its consideration, suggesting that it might have other plans for the case. And at the same time, the Loper Bright case was conspicuously absent from the December argument calendar released on Thursday, even though the case will be fully briefed by the time the argument session begins. So I don't know what the jockeying of those two things necessarily means, but my suspicion is that they wanted to make sure that they had a case regarding Chevron that included the full court. With no no ability for one side to argue one way or the other regarding when they make the final decision.
That sounds like your speculation is probably correct, but there's no real reason for them to review those things if they're going to let Chevron stand as it did. So presumably the idea would be, in fact, to cut back on the authority of these, I would suggest, unconstitutional agencies that have the executive, judicial, and legislative authorities all rolled into their work. Because, of course, we're supposed to be have separation of powers and checks and balances. We've lost that in so many places, and it's all, again, one day we should just do a whole 17th Amendment show, because the 17th Amendment is the problem, where senators were directly elected and they were turned into not representatives of the state legislatures, but rather just super members of the House of Representatives. And so that consolidated government power in the federal government by the 17th Amendment. And so it all traces back to the 17th Amendment, and one huge destruction of a major piece of the balance of our constitutional republic. And so.
Well, and there's an awful lot that is going on, you know, within the courts as well. Your two primary most conservative, quote unquote, justices, and I think you and I both would argue that they're not conservative. They're constitutional originalists, which is what the court is supposed to be made up of. Those that are looking right at the historical positions and precedents. And then using the intent of the founders in the writing of the Constitution to determine whether or not something that is presented is constitutional. And that really, at the end of the day, that's the court's purpose, is kind of above the grade of right or wrong per se, but more in line with, is the decision, is what has happened, the intent of the writers of the Constitution in the application of the rights either taken away or granted in the case before us?
Yeah, the court has assumed the position of an ongoing constitutional convention, as opposed to the application of the Constitution as it was written. There's not supposed to be an ongoing constitutional convention. If you want to amend the Constitution, there's a process for that. It's found in Article 5. There's two separate ways to do that, approach that, but it's found in Article 5. There's a way to do that. You should not be amending the Constitution by changing the meaning of words, by pretending that it means something that it didn't mean when it was written. That's the same with every law. You know, it's not just the Constitution, but every law should be, in fact, applied according to the manner in which it was intended by the folks that wrote it and passed it, presumably under constitutional procedures.
As an example, right? When you look at what is it, Title VII, I think it is, that has to do with sex, right?
Right.
The court made a decision in a case to redefine Title VII and the word sex to include gender orientation.
Yeah, nothing like that in the law. It was not there. It doesn't belong there. If somebody wants to go change the law, go lobby the Congress. If you want gender orientation added to the Title VII, then go to the Congress. You don't go to the court and say, "Oh, please amend this law for us." That's not their job, and it's never been their job. But they've taken on that job. And I'm sorry, they took on that job, and I can say why they've taken it on, and it still goes to the 17th Amendment. But that's a whole separate show. One day, just devote to the 17th Amendment and let people understand what we lost when the 17th Amendment was passed. We lost the balance that protected our rights and protected the federal government from encroachment.
And the reason that I bring that up is that this was a case decided on June 15th, 2020, that says that an employer cannot fire someone for being homosexual or transgender. And before somebody, you know, even your weak-kneed, weak-kneed Christians get all goofy on me, this specifically has to do with the ability of a church who holds to a traditional biblical interpretation of those kinds of behaviors and lifestyles, having the ability to say, no, that lifestyle, those behaviors are not allowed, and we do not employ individuals that are openly engaged in those activities because they are in violation of our deeply held belief system, and we're going to hire people that align with the guidelines and bylaws and beliefs of the church. And now, under this law, and it's, you know, it the media is not going to report this. They're not going to let you know what's happened. But under this law, churches are being forced into a very difficult situation when it comes to their hiring practices.
Yeah, to be able to have the government force them to consider and to hire people who are not adherents to their philosophical and worldview is or religious worldview essentially destroys that portion of the First Amendment that says, you know, Congress shall make no law interfering with freedom of religion. And so, of course, that does, in fact, interfere with the freedom of religion. And so, yeah, it's a thousand little cuts. And, of course, the price of freedom is eternal vigilance. And you have to pick and choose the battles where you can do your best, but you need to be in the battle.
Yeah, it's, you know, again, it just, and once you do that, now you're redefining it when it comes to schools, when you're, you know, there's a variety of areas now. And when we talk about what's happening to kids and what they're being exposed to, which is not a debate, in my opinion, it's not debatable. They are being exposed to these things. That is being done because of these kinds of decisions. In my humble opinion, David, I don't think there's any other way to view that.
No, there is no other way to view that. That's how it. Why it's post-constitutional, when we're able to be post-constitutional because nobody's been taught what the Constitution is, and they don't understand what it's about and what it's for. And then, of course, ever since Woodrow Wilson wound up with the war to save democracy, we've had the whole situation that somehow or other we're a democracy and not a constitutional republic.
There's the key.
People don't understand the advantage to themselves personally, that the Constitution is there to limit the government, to protecting their rights, to exercise their ability to pursue life, liberty, and happiness. And so it's the funny thing about it is it's not that complex. The people that are involved in the defense try and get involved with the people that make the complicated arguments about democracy and its benefits, and the folks that are defending the constitutional republic as an order fail to just go, you know, it exists to protect your rights, and it exists to protect the rights of minority of thought, and it's not a complex argument. And if people go, you know, don't you want to be out? Don't you want to be able to think what you want to think? And everybody goes, yeah, well, then why is it that I should be forced to think what you want to think? You know, it's really not complex.
Yeah. And you know, it really flows from a globalist perspective as well when it comes to the children, because the whole thing behind this is something called the Convention on the Rights of the Child. And the first state that brought that into law was the state of Washington, and they codified that. Yeah. And in doing so, it was the first step in stripping. You know, parents are stepping up now and beginning to say, wait a minute, I'm a parent here. These are my children. You don't have a right to hide things from me and impose your worldview on my child. Except that 40 years ago in the 1980s, this Convention on the Rights of the Child was introduced as law in Washington, and it has crept its way all the way across our country from one end to the other. And it's now codified in virtually every state around the nation. And so slowly, parents, without realizing it, you know, and always under the auspices, it's just like the Communism Act that I mentioned to you when we started our program, right? Well, yeah, that's a good thing. Yes, we want to, you know, I mean, when you and I went to school, we did learn about communism, and we learned that it was bad. I mean, it's a pretty straightforward thing. We understood that it was bad. Now, children, it's been taken out, and children think that Marxism is good. They come out of our education system believing that the Marxist way is the best way, which is insanity. And I get that you want to redirect that and reinstitute truth into that. But just like any of these other things, the problem is when the government has total control over the environment, you're in trouble. And that's what we're watching. And this Convention on the Rights of Children has taken away parental rights. And it's the reason why, because it says your 4-year-old and your 5-year-old is now in your household, where it used to be dad, mom, and kids, and a biblical order in your home. It's now kids, mom, and dad, maybe. And in the majority of cases, dad's thrown out the house.
Well, that's where they're, again, that's the expansion of the power of the government by they're stepping in and saying they're doing stuff to protect the children, you know, by removing the parents. The government's protecting the children. And that's Komsomol is the kids. Version of communism, where the state is in charge of the kids as well. I'm going to go back for a moment to this movie Skokie, because one of the stories there's a child of a couple of the Holocaust survivors that doesn't understand why her parents are so upset about the Nazis marching, and because the parents had always gone out of their way to try and protect their daughter from hearing the horrors that they lived through. That's another element. And somewhere along the line, the dad had to sit down with the daughter and actually explain how her grandmother went to a gas chamber. She didn't know this because they were hoping to protect her. My view of communism didn't come from education in school. It came from my grandmother, who's had eight brothers and sisters killed by communists in Lithuania. You know, and in the guise of protecting kids from these kinds of terrible things that actually go on in the world, we allow the government then to tell them that, oh, these things aren't so horrible. They're not so bad. They're, in fact, wonderful and go along with the things that Karl Marx spoke of. So they need to know the truth about stuff, too. But there's nobody actually to tell them that except their parents. And their parents, unfortunately, we've lost a generation of parents who don't any longer know about that. God bless the greatest generation who freed us from these things of the Nazis. But, you know, so many folks like my dad were stoic about things that happened in the war. They didn't want to talk about it. They didn't want to tell their kids, so their kids wouldn't grow up in a world that where they think there's this these horrible things that happen in the world. They parents that have experienced bad stuff need to be able to sit down with their kids and say, listen, there's evil in the world, and you need to be able to recognize it, and here's what I lived through. And unfortunately, that's probably a mistake that parents do make, that in terms of trying to protect their children from the bad things that are going on in the world.
Yeah.
So people should see that movie. It's available on YouTube now. It's called Skokie.
There you go.
It's full of lessons. It's full of lessons on First Amendment and children and relationship between parents and parents that have experienced horrible stuff.
And it's S-K-O-K-I-E, by the way. It's a 1981 film, Skokie, S-K-O-K-I-E.
Yeah, the First Amendment issues, the issues of Nazis and the issues of suffering and actually interreactions between kids and parents, it's all there. I would encourage people to go, and there's some tremendous theatrical performances. The actors in the movie are just incredible, and I would
And, you know, I just, to what you were saying about, you know, how kids are presented with some of this material, folks, just as coming from someone who's, you know, raised five kids, our kids were exposed to a lot of stuff growing up. We sat with them, watched movies, and then had discussions and conversations about the content of those movies. Because the reality is, no matter whether you homeschool or how you do this, your kids are going to get exposed. And your kids are going to hear a truth, or what they are going to perceive to be a truth. And you have to be the first one to that base, period. Under every circumstance, as the parent, you've got to be the first one to present that truth, so that they already have a sense of, oh, I already know this.
Right.
And that has to happen in your home. And you know, one of the things that always was so amazing to me watching my children grow up was the realization that they are uniquely made. Every one of my kids is uniquely different. Personalities are different. Behavior patterns are different. Thought processes are different. They are their own individual person. And you have to treat that accordingly. And you have to, and the sooner that you begin to respect and understand that, and I'm not talking about giving your kids authorities and liberties at an age when they can't handle it. I'm talking about just simply recognizing that, you know what, there's a lot more that they can process than you may think, and they're processing it. And if you're not being the guide to guide them in how they process it, then they're going to process it on their own, and they're going to look for another source as their source of authority on that issue. And as a parent, you don't want an outside source to become that influence on your child as they are developing. You want to be the one to bring them that. That's your responsibility as a parent. It's your job to be the one that filters the world to them and helps them to have that firm foundation to launch from. And I just felt like it was... This was a great conversation to lead into me making that comment.
Well, there's all kinds of things. It's all to do with First Amendment. Historically, parents have been in charge of their families. There's been court decisions in their favor through our history. And let's just hope we can continue to work on restoration of the constitutional republic.
Amen.
That we're talking about.
Yep.
So, it's great, and I am off to try and do some of that in a courtroom this morning.
There you go. And I've got Melanie Collette coming up with me next. And she's going to be talking about her run to try and turn representatives and to turn New Jersey red. Can you even imagine? But it can happen. It can happen. We'll be back with that coming up right after this break. David, thank you so much for being with me this morning. I greatly appreciate it, sir.
All right. Take care, Greg.